Hi friends, I'm Niamh and this is the Dark Emerald Podcast. Hey guys, welcome back to the podcast. So today's case is going to take us way back in time and it centres around the Cross family of Shandy Hall in County Cork, Ireland. Here we have a very pretty young governess, a besotted old husband, and an unsuspecting wife standing in their way. A tale of lust, betrayal, and death set in Victorian Ireland. So Philip Henry Eustace Cross, he's the man at the centre of our tale. He was born on April 15th, 1825. His ancestors came to Cork in 1599 with the Earl of Essex's army, and they acquired land around Carrigrohan and Blarney, as well as Shandy Hall and about 500 acres of land in Coachford and Dripsy. So Shandy Hall was built by the Cross family. It's an imposing country house which still retains most of its historic character, and the date stone is inscribed with the year 1758. So they were a very well established Anglo-Irish family with a long history in the area. Philip was the eldest of five children. Now, there isn't much known about his early years, but eventually he went to the Royal College of Surgeons to study medicine. And after he was qualified, on the 22nd of December 1848, he joined the British Army as acting assistant surgeon. The following year, he was in the India Regiment, and by 1855, he was promoted to staff surgeon in Turkey. By October of that year, he was serving in the Crimean War. The Crimean War itself was a terrible situation to be in. The army camp conditions were deplorable, especially for wounded soldiers, and the reports coming back to the British government were so bad that they eventually allowed a team of 83 volunteer nurses, including Florence Nightingale, to join the effort to try and get things under control. The soldiers were in horrifying sanitary conditions. Typhus, typhoid, cholera, dysentery, they were rampant. Medicines and essentials were in short supply. There was no anaesthesia. Hygiene was neglected and all sorts of infections took over. The camps themselves, they were swarming with lice, fleas, rats, filth of all kind. The nutrition for the soldiers was terrible. They had no drainage, they had no ventilation. And the nurses had to fight with military officers to try and improve conditions, provide them more supplies. But despite their best efforts and getting these extra necessities to treat the wounded and improve the sanitation, by the end of the war, they believed there was about half a million casualties, and the disproportionate number of these deaths were caused by the diseases rather than the battle itself. So all of this is to say that by the time the war ended in 1856, Philip Cross was very used to seeing people suffer and die in a great deal of distress. Bear that in mind. So, later on in his career, Philip went on to serve in the East Indies and in China. And fast forwarding a little bit to 1869, Philip is now aged about 46, and by all accounts, he was a dashing 6 foot tall army officer with, you know, a lot of worldly travel and experience. On August 17th, 1869, Philip was married to Mary Laura Marriott in St. James's Church in Piccadilly, London. Mary Laura was born on August 21st, 1840, and she was a well-born English lady. She was the third daughter of Richard Marriott, Esquire, of Abbott's Hall in Braintree in Essex. Abbott's Hall, the family home, had originally been owned by Henry VIII after he dissolved the monasteries. The estate had originally belonged to the monks of St. Osyth. Now, Mary Laura, who at the age of 29 years old, she was already considered a bit past her prime. But she was a treasured child by her parents because three of her siblings had succumbed to disease before her birth. It seemed that her father didn't approve of the match to Philip. He had misgivings about him. Maybe he didn't approve of the large age gap. Maybe he just didn't trust the man, but because of her advanced age at 29, there was some urgency about getting her married. So after her father's death, a year later, Laura inherited £5,000, which was a considerable sum and allowed the family to live very comfortably. Now, I did a little calculation. According to the Bank of England's inflation calculator, that £5,000 then would be £480,000 in today's money. And she also received an annual stipend from her brother. So Philip gained an absolute fortune by being married to Mary Laura. The couple spent the first 5 years of their marriage living in Canada, so Philip could rejoin his regiment there, and this is where the first of their three children were born. Their fourth child, would be born in Notting Hill in London. On the 27th of February, 1872, Philip was promoted to Surgeon Major, and by 1875, the family decided to return from Canada. Philip retired from the army with this new rank of major, and the whole family moved to Shandy Hall, where Philip could spend his time as a country gentleman, enjoying his avid love of hunting, and also their fifth child would be born there in 1877. So now they had five children. The children were named Sophia Mary, Henry Eustace, Philip Richard, Elizabeth Laura, and Henrietta Emmeline. So Mary Laura had delicate health, and she probably suffered from epilepsy, because at least two of the couple's children would also have epilepsy. And at the time, epilepsy carried a huge stigma, and it was considered a sign of mental deficiency. So it would have been a shameful family secret. But regardless, she was popular and she made friends in the local area. And it seems Philip was respected, but he wasn't as popular. In fact, he got himself banned from hunting in Ballincollig as a result of an incident where he severed a farmer's ear with his whip because the farmer had dared to object to Philip hunting across his land. One of the local ladies that Mary Laura made friends with was named Mrs. Teresa Caulfield. They had families of a similar age and they got along pretty well. Philip was also friendly with Captain J.P. Caulfield, who was Teresa's husband. And as of June 1886, Mrs. Caulfield had a pretty 21-year-old governess named Effie Skinner working for her, taking care of her children. Effie, whose full name was Evelyn Forbes Skinner, was a respectable young woman from a distinguished Scottish clerical family, and she was described as being beautiful. It just so happened around this time that Mary Laura decided to take an extended visit back to her home in England. Apparently, she was feeling a bit low, her marriage was under strain, and her epilepsy was confining her and making her lonely, and she thought that the trip back to Abbots Hall in July of 1886 might lift her spirits. Philip used this time to become a frequent visitor at the Caulfields' house, and despite the 40-year age gap, he and Effie grew pretty close. The Caulfields and Philip Cross, they would play cards together, and Effie would join in as the fourth player. Now, maybe he was a bit of a creep, who seemed to have a habit of picking much younger women, or maybe he was having a bit of a midlife crisis, but pretty soon he was taking a lot of interest in the young governess, with a slim waist and dark hair. Despite Philip being old enough to be her grandfather, for her part, Effie must have taken some interest in him too, because by October, she had given in her notice to Mrs. Caulfield and went to work for the Cross family as their governess instead, moving right in. I think the older children in the family, they were gone to boarding school at the time, leaving the two youngest children at home to be cared for. So it's safe to say that we can guess when the affair began. Now Mary Laura returned, and she was happy to hire Effie to help with the two youngest children, but eventually she realised something was going on. The tension in the house was unbearable, and it was evident that her husband was infatuated with the governess. So at some point she must have discovered the affair, and she confronted Philip about it. And after only 3 months with the Cross family, Effie was fired by January of the next year. They were kind enough to give her a reference, which allowed her to get a new job elsewhere. But, you know, if Mary Laura thought this was the end of it all, she was wrong. Because Philip was obsessed, and he continued to write and meet Effie in secret. In March of 1887, in fact, he left under the pretext of going to see the races in Punchestown, but instead he spent the days with Effie instead, where they acted as a married couple under assumed names. By now, Philip knew he wanted to end his marriage. He wanted to be with his new younger lover, but in doing so, he would have to involve himself into a messy divorce and put his social position at risk. He also resented his wife for getting rid of Effie, and he began turning against her. So I'm sure they did plenty of arguing, because by now Mary Laura knew about her husband's infidelity, and it seemed to take a heavy toll on her, as you can imagine. Obviously, people knew Mary Laura didn't have the best health, but not long after Effie's departure, her health went downhill rapidly. She had frequent fainting spells, and Mary Laura was becoming very ill. She had stomach cramps, vomiting, diarrhea, and terrible, terrible thirst. But, thankfully for her, her husband is a wonderful doctor. So Philip diagnosed his wife with typhoid fever, and he was very concerned about her health. He was treating her by himself, and he was calling in no other doctors for help. But some weeks went by, and there was still no sign of recovery. And on June the 1st, Mary Laura was particularly ill, and she spent the day retching, which is unusual considering typhoid fever doesn't usually cause stomach cramps or retching. But that night, one of the servants heard screams coming from her room, and poor Mary Laura was dead by the 2nd of June, 1887, and she had suffered very badly before she died. The next morning, Philip informed the household that his wife was dead, and there was a great deal of haste in Mary Laura's burial. Her body was in the ground only 2 days after she died, and she was buried in the old Protestant graveyard in Coachford. None of her friends or family attended, apart from Philip, and the whole thing was done very, very cheaply. Now, Philip, you know, he came up with a pretty convincing excuse for why he did all of this in such kind of indecent haste. He explained that she had to be buried quickly to prevent any further typhoid contagion. He also claimed the reason she was buried in the Protestant graveyard instead of the family vault was because it was full at the time. But rumours and suspicion were spreading. The family vault wasn't full. No one had been buried there for years. And to add fuel to the flames, only 15 days after Mary Laura's burial, Philip and Effie went to London together and got married in St. James's Church, the same place as his first wedding. Now Philip had finally got what he wanted. Mary Laura was gone and Effie was his beautiful new wife. Effie got the position of the mistress of the house, she got the financial security she wanted, and the big social advancement. But that wasn't the couple's only big news. Oh no, because Effie was pregnant. 3 months pregnant, in fact. But this happy homecoming wouldn't last for long. So the newlyweds returned to Shandy Hall on June 26th. The secret was out. Someone, they think it was Mrs. Caulfield, but someone alerted the authorities about the suspicious circumstances that occurred at Shandy Hall since Effie entered the Cross household, and the local Royal Irish Constabulary District Inspector, Henry Tack, began investigating. Now, Inspector Tack was 29 years old. He was clever, and with some preliminary investigation, he smelled a rat. It stood out as very odd to him that Philip had registered his wife's cause of death as typhoid fever, considering there had been no outbreak of typhoid in the area. So Tack considered with the Crown medical analyst Dr. Charles Yelverton Pearson. Dr. Pearson explained it can be very difficult to prove death by poisoning because if a poison is administered in small doses over a long period of time, all traces of the poison could be expelled from the body by all of the violent retching and purging that it causes. This type of slow poisoning meant it would be possible for someone to get away with murder. But regardless of this, Tack's investigation convinced him that an inquest should be held and that Mary Laura's remains should be exhumed. So Mary Laura's remains were exhumed on July 21st, so that meant her body had been in the ground for just over a month. A post-mortem carried out by Dr. Pearson revealed that her internal organs were in an unusual state of preservation compared to the normal levels of putrefaction of a body that had been buried for that long. There was no sign of putrefaction in the intestines, and the lungs and the heart looked healthy, which is odd for someone who had died of typhoid fever, supposedly. This good preservation raised suspicions of poisoning, and sure enough, on examination, Dr. Pearson found white particles in the gullet, which were tested and found to be arsenic. There was another 1.28 grams of arsenic found in the liver, and more found in the spleen and kidneys. But the arsenic wasn't enough. Oh no, that was taking much too long, so Mary Laura was finished off with some strychnine. The toxicology report found high levels of arsenic and strychnine in her body, and no traces of typhoid. It was Dr. Pearson's conclusion that Mary Laura had been slow poisoned over a long time with arsenic, and that a lethal dose of strychnine, which was found to still be in her stomach, was given to hasten her demise. Now, just out of interest, I looked up what it was like to die from arsenic poisoning. According to the World Health Organization, the immediate symptoms include vomiting, abdominal pain, and diarrhea, followed by numbness, as well as muscle cramping leading to death. The thing about arsenic is it has no taste or smell, so it's very hard to detect when someone is poisoning you with it, and it can go undetected very easily. Strychnine works very fast, and it's very strong, and only a small amount is needed to have extreme health effects. So after swallowing, symptoms will appear within 15 to 60 minutes. Strychnine works by preventing the proper operation of the chemicals that control nerve signals to the muscles. So it basically switches off the nerve signals to the muscles, causing severe painful spasms. The person's thinking and consciousness wouldn't be affected at first, but eventually they would be in so much muscle pain that they couldn't breathe, and they would have respiratory failure or brain death. So bear that in mind. The person would be fully aware of all of these symptoms and be in agonizing pain before they die. All of this evidence found by Dr. Pearson prompted Inspector Tack to arrest Philip Cross on the 28th of July in 1887, charging him with murdering his wife, Mary Laura, by poisoning. Now, the trial of Dr. Philip Cross began in December 1887 and drew immense interest. Every inch of available space was occupied in the courthouse. We have to imagine how taboo a case like this involving murder, a scandalous affair, an out-of-wedlock pregnancy, you know, it must have been crazy at the time. And just as the case was beginning, it was clear to all that Mrs. Cross, the new Mrs. Cross, I should say, was about to give birth, suggesting that the child was conceived around March, back when Philip had gone to visit her for those few days under the pretext of going to the races, back when his wife Mary Laura was still very much alive. So Dr. Pearson presented his evidence discovered during the post-mortem examination of Mary Laura. He found no evidence of typhoid, and he told the court he found arsenic and strychnine. A man named James Killock testified that Dr. Cross had bought a pound of arsenic from him on the 2nd of September 1886. Dr. Cross claimed that the arsenic was used for sheep dipping, which is basically making like a kind of a liquid toxic disinfectant that is put on the sheep's wool to kill off harmful insects living on their body. Regardless, it proved that there was a large quantity of arsenic at Shandy Hall, and Philip Cross knew it. This would only be the beginning of the damning testimony. There were multiple witnesses showing the breakdown of the relationship between Philip and Mary Laura after Effie's arrival. According to Cornelius McCarthy, who was a labourer employed by Philip Cross, he heard the doctor say he wished the devil would come and sweep her out of the house. About his wife, that is. Cornelius McCarthy also described the doctor giving him letters to deliver to Effie in secret. The strength of this relationship was further confirmed by William Poole, the manager of the Northwestern Hotel in Dublin, who recalled the couple coming to the hotel in March of 1887 and going upstairs together. They left the following morning to go to England, and they returned on the 21st of April. They did this on another two occasions. A neighbour of the Crosses named Mrs. Frances Kirchhoffer recalled her visit to Shandy Hall 3 weeks before Mary Laura died, saying that Mary Laura had told her that she had fainted and she thought she had a heart complaint, according to Dr. Cross. 2 weeks later, she asked Dr. Cross how Mary Laura was getting on, and he told her that her illness was as bad as it could be, that she had typhoid fever. Another friend of Mary Laura's named Mrs. Mavinia Jefferson said towards the end of May 1887, Mary Laura was very unwell, complaining of a pain in her heart and that her eyesight was failing. Mavinia said a few days before her death, she decided to leave Shandy Hall because she felt the doctor didn't want her in his home anymore, and she verified that no nurses attended Mary Laura and only Dr. Cross treated her. Then the household staff recalled the final hours of Mary Laura's life. They explained that on the 2nd of June 1887, they heard screaming coming from Mary Laura's bedroom. They said Philip came downstairs, fetched a bottle of brandy, and a few minutes later his wife was dead. He waited until the next morning to inform the staff of Mary Laura's death. Now, Philip was being defended by Craigie Atkinson, who came up with the defence that because of Dr. Cross's time served in the Middle East, he was very well acquainted with many subtler poisons. He alleged it made no sense for a man as intelligent as Dr. Cross to use arsenic, the first poison that police would think of. Instead, the defence made the case that the arsenic found in Mary Laura's insides was because she had taken it herself. A dental surgeon from Cork named Dr. Charles Butterfield declared that Mary Laura had asked him to procure arsenic for her because she had heard it was good for the complexion. Philip Cross also maintained his innocence, admitting that he had to marry Effie Skinner because he had gotten her pregnant, but that it didn't mean he murdered his first wife. The prosecution demolished these arguments, saying that while Dr. Cross was normally intelligent, he was a fool when it came to crime. He was the only suspect and the only person with a motive to murder Mary Laura. They proved that he bought the arsenic. They had all the witnesses to his affair. They knew about his poor treatment of his late wife. And they showed that he had to act quickly because he had gotten his mistress pregnant. Thankfully, the jury saw all of this. They saw that the evidence showed them that Mary Laura was murdered slowly in excruciating degrees, and that Philip was a cruel man who had watched the mother of his children suffer for weeks, pretending to be her carer as he poisoned her, all so he could marry his young and pregnant governess. It took them only 40 minutes of deliberation, and on the 16th of December 1887, the jury returned, finding Dr. Philip Cross guilty. Once the verdict was returned, Philip addressed the court for a half an hour protesting his innocence, claiming no arsenic had been found in the house apart from what was used for the sheep. He also argued that because he was 63 years of age, why would they think that he was likely to do such a thing? He also explained that he stood to lose £40 a year by her death and other money that was likely to come from her brother. Such loving, tender words, eh? He also referred to his reason for marrying Effie, saying that he wanted her to look after his children now that they had no mother. And he blamed the media for the treatment of his case and said that Mary Laura had been happy for him to be her doctor. He also tried to say that there had been a typhoid fever outbreak near their home the previous summer. On the 23rd of December 1889, Effie gave birth to the couple's son named John at Shandy Hall, and only 13 days later, on the 10th of January 1888, Philip Cross was heading to the gallows at Cork County Jail. The hangman was named James Berry, and James struggled to hang the doctor. Many of Philip's aristocratic friends came to the execution to lend Philip some support, and Dr. Cross, being grateful for their attendance, he wanted to stand facing them as he died. Berry traditionally liked to face his subjects towards the wall for execution, but each time Berry turned Philip towards the wall, the doctor would stubbornly turn around again, and he really didn't seem to give a toss what the executioner wanted him to do. finally having enough of all this silliness, an official told Barry to stop messing around and that Philip was a respected soldier and should be allowed to die facing his friends. Barry did as he was told, and Dr. Cross was hung without a word, refusing to admit his guilt until the very end. In his will, Philip left the management of his property to his brother Edward in a trust for his children from his first marriage. He also set aside £400 for the, quote, male child born of my wife on or about the 23rd of December 1887. He is not yet baptized. I desire him to be called John. He also left his second wife a legacy of £60 a year to be paid twice a year. Now that's worth about £10,000 in today's money. But if you thought that was from the goodness of his heart, no, you'd be wrong. He stipulated that Effie would only continue to receive these payments as long as she remained a widow. If she got remarried, she would get nothing. He also made it clear that this money was for caring for their son, John, and if she remarried, John was to receive the money directly until he turned the age of 21. He really just didn't care about anyone but himself, and he ruined so many lives, as well as crossing so many social barriers by having a sexual relationship with a member of his staff who was young enough to be his grandchild. But the scary thing is, because of the slow poisoning method he used, he might have gotten away with murder if he hadn't been in such a hurry to marry Effie. Effie was the person I was left with the most questions about, and unfortunately, she wasn't allowed to be questioned during the entire trial because she was the wife of the accused, and supposedly there was too much bias. I was left wondering how much she knew or suspected, or maybe if she was even an accomplice, encouraging Philip to murder Mary Laura. Regardless, she did know that Philip Cross was a married father of five. She knew and lived with Mary Laura, but she carried on an affair with him regardless. And she married him only 15 days after his wife's death. After he died, Effie Skinner slipped quietly away to England, where she vanished into obscurity. That's all for this case. I hope you found it interesting. Did Effie play a part, or do you think she was just pregnant and desperate? Let me know what you guys think. Bye! If you'd like to see any of the interesting images I found while researching this case, please follow along to my Instagram account at Dark Emerald Podcast. Feel free to like, share, send me a message. I'd love to hear your thoughts on the case. Bye!